Good evening and welcome to the Solari Report. Today's Thursday, June 8th, 2009. This is the first Solari Report of a new year. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Our first segment, as always, is Money and Markets, and we're going to discuss financial fraud. I'm going to take a bit more time than I normally do with Money and Markets, so we may run over tonight. If you have to sign off at 9, just access, and want to hear the rest, just access the MP3 tomorrow. We should have it posted by the afternoon. After Money and Market, I'm going to talk about one subscriber's question about sovereign debt. During Movers and Shakers, I'm really pleased that we're going to be joined by nutritionist Dr. Laura Thompson, and then that's going to be followed by Let's Go to the Movies. This week's movie is George Clooney's drama, Syriana. It's about the geopolitics of Middle Eastern oil, and we're going to use it to discuss a couple of current events. One is President-elect Obama's appointment for the CIA, Leon Panetta, and also what's happening in the U.S. Treasury markets. Again, we may run a bit late, so I don't want to rush the financial fraud piece. So if you need to sign off and you want to hear the rest, just get the MP3 by clicking into the control panel sometime after tomorrow afternoon. Okay, money and markets. I want to go through 12 rules of avoiding financial frauds. I believe that if you follow these rules as best you can, and of course there are always exceptions, you will find that you will be able to avoid many, if not most, financial frauds. Okay, so let's just run through them. Rule number one, in a court of law, you are innocent until you're proven guilty. However, in a financial system in the middle of economic warfare, you as a consumer have to assume that financial operations are guilty until proven innocent. Let me say that again. In a court of law, you're innocent until proven guilty. We need to assume that a financial institution is presumed to be fraudulent until proven innocent. So the goal is not to be fair. Rule number one is fairness is not the point. Our goal is to make sure that your assets and your time and your data are protected and used for your optimal benefit. Now, it's important to understand that because we're operating in a world where an individual is subject to a legal model where we are responsible for our actions, and if we engage in certain criminality, we could be penalized, we could go to prison, we could go to jail. We're functioning in a world with large corporations that have a different legal model. There is no death penalty for a corporation as a practical matter. And so the economics of lawlessness are very different for a corporation than an individual. And if we're individuals and we're dealing with large corporations and large banks, we need to understand that the economics of their legal and financial model is different than ours and act accordingly. So again, it's the opposite of the court of law. Assume that everyone is a fraudster unless you know they're not. Rule number two, do business with excellent people. If you've ever clicked onto our Bank Intimate site, we have a process that we describe about how to find a good local bank. And what you'll notice is the first thing that I look for and that I encourage you to look for is who owns an institution, who governs it, and who manages it. And what is their quality? And when I say quality, what is their competency? What is their experience? And what is their ethics? I don't look for what is the most prestigious or what is the most wealthiest, because we're in an economy where oftentimes those who are the most prestigious or the most wealthiest are the ones who are the best at fraud and criminality. So rule number two, do business with excellent people. One of the things you want to look for, because people say, well, I'm not a financial expert, how do I know these people are excellent? Look for references. In any industry or community, you know people or have network of people who have expertise in a variety of different areas. I always talk about the fact my father was a doctor, and he used to always get put on these lists of the doctors that other doctors would choose to have operate on their family. So one of the things I often look for is who are the experienced retirees in that place or that industry, and what are the institutions they choose and why. So you want to look for references and recommendations from people that you know and trust who are knowledgeable. Now, I often get sent websites of new companies to check out or financial institutions to check out. One of the ones I've gotten from about four or five people recently is a group in the Lakota Nation, according to their website, have started a gold and silver bank. And so this was sent to me with great fanfare, and yet when you go to their website, there's no disclosure of their governance structure or documentations. There's no description of who owns, who manages, who governs. There's no description of the people and their resumes and their bios and their background. So that's a dead giveaway that you either have something which is fraudulent or new or simply not competent. One of the questions I often get from people is, well, again, I don't have a lot of financial experience. How can I tell if the people are good? And one of the things I've discovered, because I often look for friends and family at a variety of different financial institutions, they'll be in Washington State, and I'll look at the financials, and they'll go into the institution and walk around and meet people. And I find there's tremendous correlation between the competency of the institution as I read the documents and the places that resonate the most with people who don't have a financial background. So if a place is competent, you can get a feel for it. I know when I was on Wall Street and did due diligence on companies, I would often, I'd just walk around the company. I'd go hang out in the cafeteria. I'd get in the elevators. I'd go up and down the elevators. I'd try and get a feel for how the place felt. And if it resonated with me, it was often a very good sign that there was a quality culture, and that led back to quality people either owning, managing, or governing. Okay, so that's rule number two, do business with excellent people. Rule number three, do business with sound institutions. If we're dealing with an institution that's going to take custody of your money, so it's a broker, it's a banker, it's somebody who's going to take custody of your funds, then you want to review the financials and you want to understand the business model. How do they make their money? You want to review the governance process and the internal controls. You want to review their experience and their history. You want to understand who's associated with them, including ensuring their soundness. Who's their auditor? Who's their law firm? Who's their insurance, their air and emissions insurance company? Who are the other professionals and partners involved? You really want to watch out for financial dependency on particular organizations, particularly if those organizations are not in alignment with you. So, for example, when I was engaged in litigation with the federal government, I would avoid doing business with companies that were highly dependent on the federal government for business. So you want to, again, you want to understand how their money works and what it means to their incentives, and how that aligns with you. Okay, so rule number three, do business with sound institutions and hopefully ones which are aligned with you. Rule number four, understand the products that you're using and where your money is going and what it's doing. How do they create their profits? Now, this is not only for a company like a bank you might do business with, but the investments you're making. So let's say we're investing in natural resource companies through our brokerage firm. We want to understand those companies and the fundamental, the fundamental logic of their profits. Do their profits come from long-lived technology? Do their profits come from patents? Do their profits come from the fact that they have incredible engineers worldwide, do their profits come from politics and dirty tricks? So you want to understand, if you can turn around and explain to a seven-year-old child or grandchild how the profits work on any company you're investing in, you're in great shape. Who and what does the company, whether it's the broker or the investment, pay to market themselves? How does the money work in their ecosystem? So you want to, if you're dealing with a broker or a dealer of any kind, you want to understand what are their commissions, what are their fees, do they pay kickbacks to other people who help market them? There's nothing wrong necessarily with all of those different payments, but you want to understand the economics of who's making money by transacting with you and how that aligns with you. If you look at the Madoff story, what we're seeing is a whole series of feeders who are making essentially a percent of the action without doing any real serious due diligence. I often tell the story of my aunt, who's a peace activist, who was investing in socially responsible investment funds and didn't realize that they were investing in Halliburton. She was investing in a concept, but never looked under the rug to see, okay, well, what are the real companies that this money is going to, and what is it that those companies are doing? So I often talk about my concern that many portfolios aren't diversified because so many of the different banks and companies in the portfolio are dependent on federal government contracts. In essence, it's not a diversified portfolio. It's really just federal contracts. Well, if you dig in and you start to really understand the economics of what you're investing in, you know, then you start to see those issues and those risks. Okay, so that was rule number four, understand the products that you are using and where your money is going and what it's doing. Rule number five, diversify. Diversify means don't just diversify the types of investments you make, both by industry and by place, but diversify the kinds of custodians you have. If you look, come back to the Madoff story, you have people who had 100% of their money in one place. If you have 100% of your money in one place, then you're not diversified in terms of custodians. If you look at the sample portfolios that we present in the audio seminar, Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, there's a before and after portfolio in great detail. And one of the things you'll see in the after portfolio is that you have far more diversification in terms of where the money is and far more in real, tangible assets that are not dependent on a third-party custodian. You'll often hear me say that squirrels leave nuts all over the place, and you want to think of yourself as a squirrel. It can make your documentation and your life more complicated in one sense, but it makes you far less vulnerable to problems with any one custodian, particularly fraud. Now, the one caveat on diversification is when you get into very uncertain markets with many, many categories going down in value, it becomes much harder to diversify, particularly if you're not in a position to invest directly in tangible assets. So there are exceptions to the diversification rule, but I would say if there's been any principle that has really protected people from loss from fraud over time, it's been diversification. Rule number six, limit the percent of money going into structured financial vehicles, or basically financial vehicles where the assets either are not there or it's just a financial bet. So for example, derivatives, options and puts and calls, derivatives, a lot of exchange-traded funds. You're basically investing in futures or what some people call synthetics. You're not investing in a real company that does real things or real assets, or some of them are held out to be real assets, but there's real skepticism. And some of these vehicles can be useful to hedge investments or a portfolio in what I call a slow burn scenario or in certain scenarios. They're kind of, I think of them as the financial equivalent of an artificial sweetener. So they can be useful in small amounts, but you do not want to get any meaningful amount of money dependent in them because you run the risk of being completely wiped out or waking up and finding that, in fact, you're the victim of the fraud. Another issue in many of these vehicles is if you look at who the manager, the asset manager, or servicer are, They're the same people whose names we've heard in the fraudulent inducement in the mortgage market, in scandals like Enron, in the $4 trillion missing from the federal government. I mean, it's basically the same seven dwarfs turning up again and again and again and again and again and again. And if they're a servicer on a particular investment, why should you, you know, why should we believe anything they say? It, you know, you couldn't believe the last, what they said in the last seven situations. So if you're going to use these things, particularly with institutions whose names are prevalent in a lot of the financial scandals of the day, you want to be really, really careful in terms of being judicious in your use. So rule number six, limit the percentage that goes into structured financial vehicles. Rule number seven, keep excellent records and pay for good help. I can't tell you how many situations where having excellent records can protect you from all sorts of shenanigans. And certainly good records are something you want to have for a variety of other reasons as well. The other thing is that in times like this, it really does pay to have good help. I'll never forget when I was a summer intern at Goldman Sachs, I walked into the corporate finance department and I had reached an agreement with one of the partners that I could sit and watch him go through the day. And he walked in, I walked in at 8 a.m. He was smoking a big cigar and he said, "Honey, the first thing you have to learn if you're going to come to Wall Street is you need a good attorney and a good accountant." And I've certainly found that's true. It's much harder to find an attorney and accountant you can trust, but if you can, they're worth their weight in gold. Let me give you a perfect example of what I mean by good help. This is a period when, because of what's going on, you'll see a lot of political pressure on the IRS to audit and be tough on people for a variety of financial behavior. Now, the problem the IRS has is there's tremendous pressure from Congress not to audit or be tough on anybody who has any political power. So what you see is the IRS ends up coming after, you know, folks like us. So now is the time to have an excellent tax preparer, not only to do your taxes, but also if you have questions or if you have issues, you want to be willing to pay them and go to them and make sure that you are informed and doing everything according to the book. So this is a time to make sure you do not save $500 by getting the cheapest tax preparer available. One of the things you're going to see is, there are very interesting issues in the spin describing Madoff and the other financials about who's the good guy. Is it the big guys or the little guys? And what I expect to see in a lot of the stories that are used as kind of teaching tools, I expect to see a lot of intimation that the little guys are the problem. You know, Madoff was a lone wolf kind of thing. One of the things I will tell you is, in my experience, it's generally the excellent little guys who are much more ethical. So when you're looking for good attorneys and you're looking for good accountants, tax preparers, keep that in mind. You're looking, I would tend to go towards the local or towards your network, but I would tend to look for people whose economics and business model are not dependent on big banks or big corporations that you may not be aligned with. Okay, so rule number seven was keep good records and pay for good help. Rule number eight, avoid the siren songs. So I'm gonna read you off a list of siren songs, and these are typical sells that are used in fraudulent situations, and or just situations that are going to get you into trouble, because sometimes the line is a bit gray as to where the fraud starts and where the incompetence stops and the fraud starts. One is quick profits. If you put this in, you'll get a double overnight. You'll get a double in a week. You'll get a double in a month. And undocumented profits is part of that. So there is, if you look at the history of economics and the history of business cycles, there's certain kinds of returns and ranges of returns which are basically appropriate for any different kind of activity. When somebody's promising miracles, there is often a problem, and you want to avoid it. And I can't tell you how many people get attracted into stupid things by the promise of ridiculous profits. You know, it's a little bit like the same psychology of a lottery. If you look at the money that's pulled out of every county in America in the lottery, if we just invested that money every year in our communities, we'd be living in heaven. But no, we're too busy being lured by the quick hit or the double. Second sort of siren song is consistent returns. It is very desirable for many people to just get a steady return and not have to live in a world that has real risks and up and downs. And in fact, what you'll see more and more is corporate executives and business people doing ridiculous things to try and create those consistent returns. And as a result, you get very unhealthy situations. In the Madoff story, again, we saw people lured in by the promise of consistent returns. Third siren song is yield traps. Oftentimes, a person will have an overhead, and they'll be looking to a certain yield to generate their overhead. So let's say they think they need $10,000 a month from their portfolio, and their yield starts to go down. They'll progressively shift their portfolio into riskier and riskier things, including looking for those quick profits that we talked about as the first siren song. To get that yield, and they're thinking, well, I need $10,000, so I'm just going to keep shifting to get that $10,000. It's at times that you want to look at your portfolio and say, wait a minute, is it possible for me to invest in my home base or in my life so that I can generate more income or lower my expenses, cut my energy bill in half, cut my mortgage in half by paying down debt? How can you use that money to reduce expenses, not just to generate yield? Because if you're taking more and more risk to generate that yield, you could get caught in the yield trap, caught in fraud, caught in all sorts of things and lose your money. That's how people ended up in IndyMac CDs that weren't insured by FDIC. They were sucked in by the yield trap. Okay, siren song number four is the magic of the black box. More and more, particularly in the 90s, you saw financial services and opportunities in the brokerage committee sold as these magical black boxes that no one could understand. We're doing all these complicated things, and trust me, it's really magical. So Enron had aspects that were black box. It's almost as though what is real is too mundane and boring to be a good investment, which is ridiculous because it's in the excellent provision and management of the mundane that the greatest businesses emerge. So reject the black box and embrace the mundane and the, you know, the everyday, if you will, because the black box in many instances is not what is promised and often can end up to be a fraud. Okay, siren song number five, exotic places, stories, and adventures. I can't tell you how many of these shaggy dog stories I hear that it's a faraway place and it's a beautiful woman or handsome man and he's gone through the perils of Pauline and it's this, and that, but it's a magical deal and you're going to get five times your money in 3 months and da-da-da-da, you know, and you hear about places like Dubai and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those stories don't align with how the real world works, but they have a magical effect on, I guess it's back to the magic that we described in the black box. People want magic, but this is not the place to get it. So, be very careful of the exotic and long-winded story and adventure. Siren song number six, too much politics and ideology. I once had a consultant tell me that a bank in San Francisco had done an analysis of the green market and customers interested in green and discovered that they would always want more services than they were willing to pay for, and there was no way to provide products to them on an economic basis. Well, not surprisingly, you would see all sorts of companies market promising all sorts of stuff in the green area that really sucked those customers in, and of course they could never deliver. So particularly in financial institutions, you want a financial institution which is good and competent at its basic business, and if they drag in too much politics and ideology, you want to be careful. Now, there's nothing wrong with any institution that says it wants to do excellently local, or it cares about its community, or it wants to align values with how its money works. That's all fine, but be careful of too much politics and ideology. Number seven, inside information. If somebody tells you that they have a hot tip, you know, from a senior corporate executive, that's illegal, that's criminal, you can go to jail. Don't fall for it. Rule number nine, you are in charge. Don't be afraid to insist on understanding everything. If a service provider will not help you understand sufficient so that you have basic understanding of what you're doing, why you're doing it, who you're doing it with, it, just leave, pull out. You have the right to have intellectual mastery of anything you or your money is doing, and you are paying people to help you have that. That's what makes you powerful with your money, is having that kind of knowledge. If they won't teach, if they hoard knowledge, particularly if they won't be clear about how their economics work, just leave. And that means if never, ever tolerate bullying or intimidation. If anybody in the financial system starts to bully you as the customer or make you feel stupid or intimidated, something is wrong. Get out. I've seen many of the most, the largest, and until the bailouts, the most respectable firms use bullying and intimidation, and of course what they were doing is they were selling fraudulent stuff, and they were using bullying and intimidation and complexity to do it, and it was fraudulent, and if you look at people's portfolios, sure enough, it reflects that. Rule number 10, little frauds and big frauds are part of the same system, and we need to protect ourselves against both. So let me say what give you a description. Madoff, even though it was $50 billion, is a little fraud. It's one guy, one company, and his investors. Now, of course, we know there's a much deeper story, and we haven't heard what it is yet. It hasn't come out. So that's a little fraud. It's one guy. It's the lone fraudster. What Treasury and the Federal Reserve have been up to for the last 50 years, and certainly particularly since 1995, with a strong dollar policy, is a very big fraud. $4 trillion is missing from the federal government. The bailouts, trillions are being handed over to these firms, are saying they refuse to disclose what they're using the money for. So we need, both of those are connected, because a Madoff can't exist without systemic support from the powers that be. I've talked about that in other Soleri reports. We can be harmed by both. Some people tend to focus more on the little frauds and be afraid of the little frauds. Some people tend to focus more and be afraid on the big frauds. What we need to understand is they're both part of one system, and we need to understand them both and protect ourselves against both. And when the little fraudsters are used as scapegoats to protect the big fraudsters' credibility and to try and engineer more power and control through more enforcement, as I suspect the Madoff scandal is going to be used, we need to be careful and remember what the game really is. Okay, so rule number 11, be aware of high-tech fraudsters. In one sense, this is a much longer conversation, but you know, all the different technologies that we're seeing when we discuss these different movies like Enemy of the State or Syriana or some of the other movies we're going to discuss, all of these surveillance techniques are now used in economic warfare. So Enron listening to private municipal conversations by decision makers in a municipality so that they could get inside information that would help them get a government contract. So beware of the high-tech techniques that are now applied to some of these frauds. Finally, rule number 12, no system is perfect. You and I could follow every one of these rules perfectly and still be susceptible to some kind of fraud. So it's very important when you do your personal and professional planning, if you look at how much you can afford to spend or how much you need to afford to save for your retirement, you want to build in a contingency. Financial fraud is a risk, particularly in this kind of world, and you need to make sure you have time and money built into your budget to deal with the possibility of it. Okay, so those are 12 rules. If you they'll be on the MP3 if you need to listen to them again and digest them. But I really think if you practice these 12 rules, they will protect you from a remarkable amount of the craziness in the environment. Okay, now one of the things I wanted to talk about in money and markets is what's up in the treasury market, because it relates to what we're going to look at in the movie Syrian. I'm going to move that back to the end of the tonight's Solari report and jump ahead to Ask Catherine. We've gotten some great questions from subscribers. All the precious metals questions we're going to address next week with Franklin Sanders, or next month when James Turk joins us in February. So I'm going to leave the precious metals for next week and next month and jump to a great question we got from somebody from New Zealand. Does debt compromise a nation's sovereignty? They asked it in the context of New Zealand, but in fact it's a great question for every nation. I've talked a lot and written a lot about what has been happening since the strong dollar policy was implemented, with assets being moved out of government's hands into private hands, sort of what's called privatization. I call it piratization. One of the most important piratizations going on is the movement of gold inventories out of the central banks and out of government into private hands. Now, what has been happening is as assets move out of government into private hands, we're watching liabilities get moved back in. So government is picking up the liabilities for the banks on the bailouts, and they're picking up the liabilities now for the auto industry. We had Larry Flint yesterday. You'll see it in Top Picks. Demand that the Congress bail out the adult, what did he call it? Well, it's the pornography industry. It was quite funny. So we're seeing assets stripped out of government and liabilities move back in. As that happens, the debt that is remaining, because there are not enough assets to cover it, becomes a vehicle by which the financial sovereignty of the nation is compromised and the nation can be controlled. So imagine if you're running a company and you're dependent. You know, you have no assets, you only have debt, and the bank controls your debt. Well, then the bank, of course, controls your company. So for a nation to be sovereign, you need several things. You need financial sovereignty, and you need information sovereignty. You need government officials need the ability to confer, discuss, keep secrets, and keep certain information private. We have reached a point now in many nations where the stripping of assets combined with the debt has compromised a nation's financial sovereignty, and the control of government data and bank accounts by private entities, whether banks or defense contractors, has completely compromised the nation's information sovereignty. So the question is, does debt compromise a nation's sovereignty? Yes. The most important issue is to look at the debt relative to the assets. You'll see some countries that have debt, but they have fantastic wealth, sovereign funds, and so the debt won't compromise in that position. But too much debt absolutely compromises a nation's sovereignty. Okay, so movers and shakers. Tonight we're going to be joined by Dr. Laura Thompson, who is a nutritionist in California. Her website is drlaurathompson.com. She is a healer who's brought many people back from health against all odds. It's, you know, some of those incredible stories, and I know because I'm one of them. So as a matter of disclosure, I am one of Laura's many clients and one of her very happy clients. One of the things I encourage everyone in the Solari Network, and certainly all the subscribers of the Solari Report, to actively make an effort to understand what's going on, what I sometimes call the real deal. And that can be sort of a, you know, leaving the bubble that some of us live in America and really facing what's really going on can be very overwhelming at times and very depressing at other times. But the advantage of doing it is that you start to understand real actions you can take to protect yourself and your family. And to me, there's no more important area than in health. And I just have to get on my bandwagon before I bring Laura in and explain. One of the things I see again and again throughout throughout the world, it's not just in America, but and I travel a great deal both in America and abroad, is that many of us don't understand the extent to which we need to proactively protect, invest time and money in really protecting and nurturing our health. And if I could, one of the reasons I wanted you to hear Laura today is to help you understand the importance of this and the possibility of it, because I know, you know, good health can make all the difference. So, Laura, are you with us?
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, listen, I just realized that one of the things that I talk about is nutritional sovereignty.
Really?
Well, in a way. I mean,
that's a fabulous term.
Well,
why don't we start there? Why don't you introduce nutritional sovereignty?
Well, okay. I think that one of the focuses of what I do with people is, you know, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, helping them be their own doctor.
Right.
Or helping them be their primary health advocate. And, you know, because really, who knows better than you? You know, what you need, how you feel.
Right.
And, you know, the barrier with most people is that they just don't know how to do that. They don't have the information. And so I utilize various forms of education, various forms of lab testing to help people get the information they need so then they can, you know, just, you know, build a firm foundation, help their families get stronger.
One of the things that you've taught me is the importance of testing, of having, you know, it's kind of like having a barometer of knowing where you are physically and you know, are you healthy, and if not, why? And it never occurred to me, I know this sounds really stupid, it never occurred to me that I could get extensive and very professional testing without going back into the traditional health system. And I've learned a great deal. So I would love if you could describe the kind of testing that is available.
Sure.
and the benefits of doing it.
Yeah, sure. A really common thing for a person to say to me, you know, when they start, you know, consulting is I've had blood work done. Well, I have two types of patients. People who come to me for just general purposes, you know, what they want to just make themselves stronger, have more energy, and or have mysterious symptoms that haven't been uncovered. And the second type of person is the person who comes for a specific condition or disease. And usually with both of those categories, people will say, I've done testing, and usually they're talking about lab blood work, a blood or urine test from, you know, their medical doctors, and it showed nothing. Or what it showed was, you know, just something borderline, but yet they have these symptoms that they feel, and they're told that they're okay. And the problem with that is that the blood tests often don't show anything until the problem has manifested to be a lot more serious. And the types of testing that we run find the problem before they become a problem.
Right.
So we have different types of lab tests, and these are all done, most of them actually are collected in your home, because I do work long distance. I have 75% of my practices by phone. And the labs are all medical labs throughout the country that you collect either urine, saliva, or stool, and the test kit then gets sent to the lab, and, you know, each test obviously shows different things. Probably the most common test that my patients have, I would say the most common test is probably the hormone test, because I'm known as a hormone specialist. And even the men I work with get hormone tests, even the teens and the children get hormone tests. And that's done through the saliva. It's a 24-hour collection, and the reason for that is, well, first of all, the saliva shows the comprehensive existence of hormones in the body rather than the blood, which only shows you what's in the blood. The saliva shows you what's, you know, freely available in the other tissues. But hormones cover more than just what we think of, you know, whether we think of menstruation or sex or fertility. There's so much more, you know, that hormones are involved with. And so when I work with people with energy problems, metabolism issues, weight gain, sleep problems, people trying to get off their antidepressant medications, they all go and get, they all do the saliva testing for the hormones.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and one of the favorite tests of my patients in the past few years is that of neurotransmitters, because the neurotransmitters are the brain chemicals that, you know, help us, you know, think better and emote better and sleep better and feel better, feel that sort of sense of well-being. And the brain chemicals can now be assessed through urine testing. It's pretty common that I work with people with gut infections, diarrhea, constipation, candida, yeast problems, parasites, malabsorption issues. And so stool testing is available. And I also do biofeedback testing, which we can talk about, too, in this call, which is...
Which is fascinating.
That one has totally revolutionized my practice.
Right. And it's I remember the first time I used a biofeedback machine was about 5 years ago. And it took a couple times to kind of even grok that such a thing existed and really worked. You know, because it seems so, I don't know, it's so quantum, not mechanical.
Right.
But it's, I will say, now that I've been working with you for a while, I'm stunned as I travel around the country. I can really see all these different people who think they have very different problems, but if you look at it in a very broad way, they all really have two problems, which is their immune systems are suppressed and they're struggling under a huge load of toxicity. And if you could just talk about those two things, I would really appreciate it, because I would love for everyone listening to this call to really understand the opportunity, well, the extraordinary toxicity which we're dealing with, and the things that suppress immune system and the many things they can do to reverse that.
Well, when I look at the amount of I don't even know how many toxins there are. I mean, you read all these incredible tens of thousands of, you know, these figures that, you know, people assess how many toxins there are in our environment. But there, you know, toxins are everywhere, and I think really, you know, we're not going to get rid of them.
Right.
And we just have to do our best to take control where we can, which is basically in our home, and make your immune system strong so that when you are in the presence of something toxic, you don't get affected by it, or it doesn't, you know, take root in the body. You can actually excrete it. So, yeah, it's basically eliminate the offenders as best as you can by staying away from them to begin with, and or helping your body become a better detoxifier so you can eliminate through the liver, the lungs, the lymph, the kidneys, and really try to build the immune system. There's lots of ways to build the immune system. The most potent way to build the immune system, really, because over 60% of it is in the intestinal tract, is by enhancing the digestion and working on, you know, the pancreas, the spleen, the liver, the bowel function, because this is where the majority of your immune system is at work.
Right.
And so that's really the first thing I look at when I work with someone, and I go into quite a bit of detail, probably deal with a lot of gross questions and answers on that, but everybody gets used to it. That's really the most important place to start in strengthening the immune system is looking at, are the bowels moving at least twice a day? If you're eating 2 to 3 meals a day, the bowels should be moving, you know, that often.
Right.
And, you know, then we go into, you know, what a bowel movement should look like, and, you know, I won't go into all that right now. But as far as eliminating the toxic load, you know, the phenomena is so many toxins have accumulated in our environment a lot more quickly than our immune systems have been able to get strong.
Right.
And maybe one day, you know, it won't be an issue. I don't know. Are we always going to be behind, you know, behind the curve, or are we ever going to get ahead of the curve? But, you know, all we really have to do is make ourselves as strong as possible. And, you know, some of that, of course, is going to be by eating pure food. In fact, that's your most important thing, is to, you know, I guess the term, the term I use is smart food. Smart
right.
food is slow food, you know, takes time to grow, takes time to prepare, takes time to cook. And, you know, all that time is, you know, I guess in financial terms, is really your investment.
Right.
You know, it's the payoff is your life.
Right.
And then, you know, there's so much involved with the toxins in fast food, and then we can go down the list of caffeine and sugar and all the, you know, sort of treat foods that we've come to be eating on a daily basis. I don't know, when I was a kid, well, I'm going to give away my age, but in the late 50s and early 60s, you know, dessert was once a week for me,
right.
anyway, you know, and soda was like, that was never on a daily basis.
Right.
And I'm sure people were consuming caffeine, but the amounts of sugar and caffeine, I mean, I have my patients do food diaries, and I, you know, I do a lot of, I guess, which we call detective work. My husband calls me the food police. But, you know, when I found out all of the habits that people have, I couldn't believe it. I don't know if I would exist if I did all the things that everybody does. You know, drinking wine 2-3 glasses a night and 4 or 5 cups of coffee a day. All of this stuff is just, it's just making, I understand it's kind of a catch-22 because, you know, we're trying to have energy and we're trying to have vitality and we're trying to spark our brains in the morning to go forward and accomplish all the things we have to accomplish. And then we go through the stress of the day and we come home and we want to, like, chill out.
Right.
But it's really tweaking the body. And,
can you talk a little bit about Alzheimer's and whether or not Alzheimer's has to happen?
Well, Alzheimer's, you know, all conditions have multiple causes. There's never one thing that causes a problem. That's really what the word holistic means. Alzheimer's, you know, you have to look at it from different angles. I took a brain seminar, I think I told you this a couple of weeks ago. I took a brain seminar several months ago, and the presenter said something so incredibly impactful to me, and it's like a room full of 100, 200 holistic practitioners, said, you know, you guys are guilty of the same thing the medical doctors are guilty of, and that is that treating people as if they have no heads.
Wow.
And basically what he was saying by that was, you know, we don't really look that much at brain nutrition. Oh, yeah, everybody's taking fish oil or lecithin or ginkgo or, you know, different things that we sort of have a general idea about what the brain means, but how really deep are we going into that? So the problem with Alzheimer's is that, number one, the DHEA, adrenal stress hormone, the adrenal
mm-hmm.
glands in the low back above the kidneys make a hormone called DHEA. So most, if not all, Alzheimer's patients have low DHEA levels, which means they've gone through a significant amount of stress, and the body is really tired, and that, you know, it's kind of like the brain saying, hey, you know, I've had enough.
I quit.
Right.
Right.
And, of course, you have the commonly known cause of Alzheimer's, which is heavy metals or aluminum or, you know, various toxins that get into the brain. And you know, that was the gist of that's the gist of my most recent education about Alzheimer's and senility and memory problems, and even starting with brain fog, which, you know, half of us have. That's just, you know, somebody tapping you on the shoulder, your body saying, hey, pay attention here. This is the beginning of something. And you can turn that around. You know, this is somebody doesn't just wake up one day with Alzheimer's. They
right.
have taps on the shoulder a lot, you know, younger, and years before, and that's what needs to be paid attention to. So for someone with Alzheimer's that's full-blown,
mm-hmm.
I can say that I've seen it, you know, stop it in its tracks where it doesn't develop any further. I've seen people in early stages reverse it to some extent, and I've seen certain people with senility absolutely reverse it. But it all kind of depends on the degree to which the brain is degenerated.
Right.
You know, and the causes of the degeneration. Like, does the person really want for it to reverse? Are they happier not knowing what the heck's going on around them? I mean,
right.
that's, you know, that inherent thing inside of them that said...
Well, I will tell you, I've been astonished at the difference in my ability to deal with complex information as a result of all the work we've been doing together. And I've seen it with other people that I've referred to you, that literally, you know, because the amount of sort of information I'm dealing with, both doing the Soleri Report and in my other business, is enormous. I mean, it's just a huge flow, and I think everybody feels that way. We're overwhelmed with information,
mm-hmm.
Just trying to stay current as well as do whatever it is we do every day and do what we do with our families and household. It's a lot of stuff.
Oh, it is.
And so, you know, taking the time to figure out, that's why I get back to the testing, finding out what it is that's causing less than peak performance and attending to it, you know, it really is worth the time and effort. And you know, and it's a lot of effort because I'm somebody who hates taking vitamin pills.
Yeah, and you're doing a pretty good job.
It's a lot of stuff.
But you're right. You know, you have to get a baseline to know where you're at. And luckily, you know, these kinds of tests are, you know, we're not diagnosing diseases here. We're looking at precursors, you know, to problems.
Right.
And, you know, the simple solutions are eating non-toxic food, and in that we also go into allergens. The biofeedback testing is really excellent for looking at things you're sensitive to or allergic to. So allergic foods or environmental toxins can be just as bad. And then looking at what it's going to take to regenerate your body. So customization of your health program, which I'm assuming that a fair amount of your listeners are pretty proactive already. And,
right.
You know,
the people who subscribe to the Soleri Report really do pay attention to health.
Yeah. Yeah,
they really do.
I can imagine that they would.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole thing is really, I mean, I don't discourage people from like I said, being their primary health advocate. I think that's what I like for people to end up in, you know, my patients when I release them and say, okay, you're on maintenance. You can do this yourself now. I think, though, that it does help to have someone to kind of take the overview who can look from the objective outside your body, because sometimes we make decisions for ourselves, you know, based on emotional things that maybe somebody else wouldn't.
Can you talk a little bit about vaccines, too? Because I'm still stunned at the extent to which, you know, people are allowing their children or grandchildren to get vaccines.
I'm stunned, too, and even in my own patient population, so I do educate my patients about vaccines. And I don't tell them not to, but certainly, you know, that's definitely a really personal decision for the children. I mean, it must be hair-raising decision for parents. But I was stunned at the amount of my patients that were getting flu shots.
Really?
Yeah, I was stunned because I put out newsletters about it, and... I'm totally against flu shots. I think they're horrible. I mean, why do we need them? You know, that's the thing that gets me. It's just all about your immune system. If your immune system is strong and you have techniques to use, especially in the winter, using vitamin D, you know, have your immune-enhancing supplements, you know, your arsenal ready
right.
to go, then you should go through the whole season without a cold or flu. And that's what I love to hear from my patients is, you know, the family went through the whole Christmas season without getting sick.
Uh-huh.
But as far as the vaccines are concerned, there's so, I mean, you could do a whole call just on, I mean, books have been written on on the topic. The problem with vaccines is that I think the thing that bothers me most about the whole topic is they're assuming that we're weak. You know, when you assume that you're weak, then you're going to be weak.
Right.
And the problem with the vaccines is that they don't really, you know, your body has the strength to withstand infections. And when you put vaccines, you know, into the body, you're getting tons of toxins, not the least of which is metals. The mercury and the aluminum. I just finished writing my book, Our Children Are What Our Children Eat, and I did a chapter on vaccines. So I've done quite a bit of research about them, and I was just amazed at the amount of toxins, including formaldehyde, you know, and of course, then you're dealing with, some of them have the live viruses,
right?
Which, you know, and then there's the flu nasal spray. Oh, my heavens. I mean, that. Imagine you get that nasal spray right by the thin barrier that protects your brain.
Right.
And then the virus goes into the brain.
Right.
Or, you know, or has the ability to do that. So I have a program that I recommend for parents. If you do decide to vaccinate, then your child should be fortified before the vaccinations and after the vaccinations. Because, you know, it's really important that people do whatever it is they feel that they're not going to regret, you know,
right.
Whatever they want to do. I recommend not doing it, but, you know, I can't tell them, not to, because they need to do what they feel is right. But at least fortify your child beforehand and afterwards.
Right.
You know, so that they can detoxify the toxins out of the body, which is, you know, this is why a lot of the autism has occurred. Because the autistic kids do not have the ability to detoxify, you know, the ingredients.
Right.
Whether it be a vaccines or, you know, casein or gluten or whatever it is. They're just not good detoxifiers. So I think some people are just inherently a little bit weaker as far as detoxification. And then, so you just need to build that. And, you know,
well,
plenty
for
of
me,
us have had vaccines and we're okay, too, you know.
Well,
maybe
for me, the moral of the story is this is an area where investing your time and money can make a huge difference to your life, and you need to do that before the problem surfaces. So, you know, and it's remarkable the difference that this kind of investment can make. So with that, Laura, is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Just, you know, give power back to the people. You know, get yourself strong. You know. Oh, and I did want to say that I decided to give a discount to any of your listeners. So we're going to give a 25% discount on.
Oh, great.
Consultation.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's commonly done on your calls or not, but I figured why not.
And your website is Dr. Laura Thompson, and it's the Southern California Institute of Nutrition, and they can call and find all the contact information from your website.
Phone number is 800-608-5602.
Okay, well, Laura, thank you for everything
you
do.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
Have a great evening.
You too.
Okay, well, that was Dr. Laura Thompson. I find it amazing that I have become as interested in health as I am today. If, you know, when Laura was talking about the people with the caffeine and the Coca-Colas, I can remember sitting on the trading floor in Wall Street digesting huge amounts of caffeine and sugar. Anyway, so let's go to the movies. Tonight we want to talk about Syriana, which is an extraordinary movie. It was one of the executive producers was George Clooney, who stars, in fact, as a CIA agent in the movie. And I hope you had a chance to watch it, but I'm going to try and persuade you, if you haven't, to absolutely watch it. It's a different kind of a movie. It's not entertaining like Enemy of the State. It's really in some ways, it's a depressing movie because it's really taking you through the real deal. You're really seeing how things work. It's the story, for those who haven't seen it, it's the story of an oil company. company. There's several threads, but one is an oil company that has failed. It's been thrown out of a country, which is a metaphor for Saudi Arabia. It's lost a big contract to the Chinese, and it's trying to get a merger to buy a smaller company that's gotten a big contract in one of the Eurasian countries. And the merger is held up at the Department of Justice, and we go back and forth between the Middle East and Texas and Washington and the geopolitics of oil. And it's a subtle movie. In fact, to understand it, I've had to watch it several times. The reason I chose it is it in the movie there is a Saudi prince who explains to the character played by Matt Damon why he doesn't invest in his people and his country, and why so much of the oil money is wasted. And it's a fabulous depiction of a leader explaining the fact that he has very few options that many people think he has. I'm always amazed at the extent to which many very capable and intelligent people in the Soleri Network or throughout America really believe that presidents of the United States or Congress people or business leaders have all sorts of options to act that they really don't have. They're dealing within a system, and their options to move, they can't move against the system, and they certainly can't move in non-alignment with the economics of the system. What you see in Syriana, the sort of end of the movie, is the prince in the Middle East country who is bringing the Chinese in for a contract is politicked out of the job to be the next emir, the leader of the country, by his younger brother, who does a deal with the Americans and agrees presumably to let the Americans bring in a military base and have a stronger military presence and to bring the American company back in to take control of the oil. When the first prince tries to engineer a military coup, his car, including his wife and family, is taken out by a missile, which is directed by a group of people sitting back at Langley in the CIA in America. And you watch the scene of the intelligence agency basically execute the assassination of a foreign leader because he opposes American oil interests in the Gulf. Now, we talked about the movie Enemy of the State. In Enemy of the State, you see the intelligence agency commit assassination as if they're a principal. In Syriana, you see the intelligence agency commit assassination simply as the white-collar bureaucratic assassin, which is working for and beholding to business and market interests. And it's a much more realistic depiction of the dynamic in the system than you see in Enemy of the State. No one has sovereignty. Everybody's part of a system, and that system has an economic imperative that makes the system go the way it wants. And the prince's explanation to Matt Damon is one of the great scenes of really the movies teaching people how things really work. I often hear people say, why is it that no one does anything? And what I come back to again and again and again is throughout the planet, throughout the world, we see prime ministers and presidents and CEOs who are absolutely living in a world where if they don't behave within certain constraints, they or their families can be killed. They can be threatened in a variety of different ways. They can be harassed, whether it's a smear campaign or physical harassment. So you have all these constraints on people if they don't go in the way that the people who have the power and the invisible weaponry want them to go. Now, And Syriana really underscores that the constraints on people who we think of as very powerful and having much more latitude to act than they necessarily do. So it's one of the reasons I recommend Syriana is to understand that. Another thing I wanted to mention tonight was the appointment of Leon Panetta as the new head of the CIA by President-elect Obama. When Leon Panetta is the former OMB budget director and former chief of staff to President Clinton during the Clinton administration, if you look at his resume, he's someone who understands the real economy and understands the engineering of the U.S. and global economy through the federal budget and credit. That's what the head of OMB does. I used to have a colleague who said that the job of the federal government and organizations like the Department of Justice and CIA was the control and concentration of cash flow. Well, there's no one more superbly positioned to understand that than Leon Panetta. So let's go back to the CIA and Syriana. If, as you see in Syriana, the CIA's job is to help engineer those cash flows, then Panetta's background makes a lot of sense because he is someone who is able to understand the state of economic flows and economic warfare and integrate it with intelligence and military warfare because of the background as OMB budget director. So watching Syriana, it starts to make a lot more sense that Leon Panetta was chosen to run the CIA. Now, I put up on the blog a post about, it's called The Fix Is In, and it's about what's up in the Treasury market. We've had a series of really remarkable statements by mainstream press, corporate media, or people with impeccable resumes in the mainstream. They worked at the Bank of England or they worked at the Treasury, predicting the collapse of the dollar or real trouble in the Treasury market. Barron's had an article called Get Out Now. Former Bank of England official expects dollar collapse. I didn't see it, but one of the subscribers reported watching Lou Dobbs on CNN interview David Walker, the former general controller of the currency, and used the default word. It was Lou Dobbs, not David Walker, which is quite remarkable. All of these happening literally in the same week says to me, okay, something's up. The reality is we still don't know what it is. The dollar last year had enjoyed an incredible bubble in complete defiance of the fundamental economics. We talked about it at the year-end wrap-up. The dollar was up 5% for the year versus gold, which was up 4%, versus the Dow, which was down 35%. So the dollar's had a remarkable run. On one hand, we have all the media predicting the dollar's about to collapse. On the other hand, we have Obama announcing a $700-plus billion, almost a trillion-dollar budget stimulus package for infrastructure and tax cuts, announcing it sitting at a table with the luminaries of Paul Volcker and Bob Rubin. Well, how are they going to spend a trillion-dollar budget stimulus and have tax cuts if the dollar's about to collapse? It doesn't make any sense. So you kind of wonder what this is all about. The answer is we still don't know. When you get these kind of runs in the corporate media, I'm always worried that we're into some kind of pump and dump, but it's hard to see the sides. The possible scenarios we're going to have to prepare for this year is, one is the dollar could stay high, and it could stay high just for the reasons that we saw in Syriana. The United States has the premier satellite network. It has the premier invisible weaponry. It has shares with the sort of Anglo-American and European alliance superb intelligence capabilities. And if we have the ability to kill leaders worldwide and their families, it starts to get easier to understand how the dollar could stay high despite any economic rationale for a strong dollar. And that's why, again, I wanted you to watch Syriana, even though it's not the most entertaining movie, because if you look at the blog, there's an old post saying that I wrote called The Military Keeps the Dollar Up. And you might want to, if you haven't read it, relook at it. But we could have a high dollar or a dollar that stays high this year despite everything because of that global military presence. It does mean that things could get meaner and much more violent. So one scenario is the dollar stays high. Another scenario is the dollar falls back to the previous lows. And then finally, one scenario that's being discussed more and more is the radical devaluation of the dollar. I posted up on the blog a comment by one of the former federal governors pointing out that the federal balance sheet did not look as bad despite the $7 trillion of debt if its gold was revalued to market on the balance sheet. Now, in a situation where we have a radical devaluation overnight, we could literally wake up tomorrow and the dollar, the fundamental value of dollar would be radically shifted versus gold. And it would be one way to take care of the debt problem because you would literally, those with tangible assets would be able to pay off their dollar debts much more easily with inflated dollars. So we still don't know, but it's one to watch. And I think watching Syriana can help you tremendously start to understand a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes. So we have reached a point where physical and military warfare and economic warfare have integrated and continue to integrate and have the benefit of high technology, including technology we don't necessarily understand behind them. And it's very much behind what's making it possible to manage and manipulate markets to the extent that we're watching. Okay, so looking ahead, don't forget to send your questions. We've got great questions, a lot on precious metals that we're going to try and address next week with Franklin Sanders. If for any reason you can't or don't want to post your questions on the panel, please feel free to put them on the blog post for tonight's Solari Report, which is entitled Financial Fraud, the Tip-Off. Next week, we're going to have Franklin Sanders Thursday, February 15th, with our precious metals update, which I'm hoping we can do once a month. The following week, we're going to have a special on the Godfather series, part 1 and 2 and 3. The Godfather series is one of the best movies I have, or series of movies I've ever found to explain how our economy really works. If you look at 1, 2, 3 together, that's a lot of movie watching, so you might want to start watching now in anticipation of when we do the special 2 weeks from now on Thursday evening, February 22nd. So, in closing, again, I want to thank you so much for being a subscriber to the Solari Report. You and yours are always in our prayers, and particularly for this new year. Remember, we ask you not to worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night, and good luck.